Rich. And thank you, Rich, for organizing this entire conference and for giving us all the opportunity to be here with you and your colleagues and guests and participants. Second, I want to quickly thank Martine Spurlander Tolson-Olson for a magnificent job of formatting a set of PowerPoint slides. You'll see my name above the logo and legend of Munger, Tolson-Olson on the first slide, albeit I have no affiliation with the firm. It's Martin's firm. I'm an independent arbitrator mediator from New York, but I'm also an amateur PowerPoint, so I couldn't quite figure out how to move my name away from that. So, quickly, I'm going to do very quick introductions of everyone because you have biomaterials, but I promised everyone that I would do a little bit. These people are all off to a great start in their careers as international arbitrators, I would say. From my left to right, Martina Estrada is a litigation partner in Munger, Tolson-Olson in Los Angeles. Started his legal career modestly as an executive editor of the Stanford Law Review and went on to clerkships on the Central District of California and the Ninth Circuit. As if that wasn't enough of a start, he then was the head of the organized crime strike force in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, and from there proceeded to private practice where he has distinguished himself not only as his peers, but has received a number of awards. I think I saw one California Lawyer of the Year for some relevant year, but we're very pleased that Martin is able to join us. Then to his right, another arbitrator whose career is off to a fabulous start is Judge Sofair, it's not possible really to adequately summarize his career, but he started his legal life after law school clerking to Justice Brennan, went on to teach as a professor for 10 years at Columbia Law School before becoming a judge in the Southern District of New York, where he succeeded Judge Martin Frankel, who left the bench to become partner of the firm where I started my career and my mentor. Judge Sofair then went on to be legal advisor to the State Department and segueing to current times, but since the mid-80s, he has been a fellow at the Hoover Center at Stanford, teaching at Stanford Law School, and I'm not quite sure how recently, but perhaps in the last decade or so, formed what is now the Prominent Arbitration Center in California, FedArb, of which Judge Sofair is a leader, and many judges, former judges and leading practitioners are arbitrators associated with FedArb. We're really privileged to have Judge Sofair with us. To his right, EY Park, joining us from Seoul, Korea. EY is a giant in the world of international arbitration in Asia. He is the co-head of arbitration at the largest law firm in Seoul, Kim & Chang. He is, among other things, vice chair of the London Court of International Arbitration, and I think that status says it all, because it's one of the most highly regarded international institutions, so to be a vice chair of that is a sign that you, like the rest of us, up and coming, and you have a future in international arbitration. And to my immediate left, Jack Levin from New York. Jack, after graduating from the University of Pennsylvania Law School and working as an associate in Davis Polk & Wardwell, New York's most prominent prestigious firm, formed his own firm, which became so successful, largely to Jack's efforts, that Covington and Berlin could not resist acquiring Jack's firm.
They merged with us.
After 1999, where Jack spent the rest of his career as a large law firm lawyer, as a senior litigation partner of Covington and Berlin in New York from 1999 until 2011, when he took retirement to become a full-time neutral. He is, among other things, on the AAA's master mediator list, that's large M, large M, But I'll say he's not only a master mediator, but considered among the New York International Arbitration Bar to be a master arbitrator as well. So we're very pleased to have Jack here as well. So that's the who's who, and now we're trying to talk about our topic. And you see in the big headlines, it's labeled as a discussion about discovery. And it is in part, but we're going to use discovery and as is politically correct in international arbitration to speak about disclosure or information exchange. But we'll use that a bit as a springboard to get into a broader discussion about first, topic number one to be focused on by Abe and Jack, due process and arbitration, that we've heard about a little bit already. And second, to be focused on by Martine and EY, cultural aspects of arbitration, and in that context we'll discuss maybe a hybrid set of facts, which is not so atypical, where a case has various aspects that might characterize it as a U.S. case, might characterize it as an international case, and it could go either way, and its internationality or not is somewhat up for grabs. So, just to start off on the due process topic, I did a couple of background slides, and I'm not going to recite through them, but you can read down the list. And what I want to use the term lightning round, and you heard about this in the discussion that, that preceded, that due process really covers over every arbitration, and especially international arbitrations. And I've given a list of examples here of that are just various procedural elements that would be familiar to most of you. And think about how often some party in the process, in the discussion, the very discussion of whether there should be depositions or whether there should be rejoinder memorials, considers it to be a matter of due process, and if they don't get their way, they're going to be very upset with the tribunal and the issue with the award. So we have that laundry list, and here I've sort of asked rhetorically why the due process preoccupation. I think one simplistic or simple way is to answer that is to say that to the extent we have judicial review, review folks, it's focused on process and not on the merits. Ironically, you know, when you read writings by civil law professors in Europe, they say that the United States uniquely is a jurisdiction where there is merits review. And you see that because the doctrine of manifest regard, as it's regarded by civil law writers, is regarded with horror and something that really is intrusive, while empirical evidence is to the contrary. But the last point I made is that because the unfairness in the process is a better prospect for contesting the award, due process issues cover over the case. So quickly, we have some background, just a little black letter law to tee up the discussion. All of this will be familiar to you. We have the Section 1083 of the FAA with respect to arbitrations seated in the United States, where the relevant court at the seat would be the court to hear a motion to set aside. And one possibility is where the arbitrators were guilty of misconduct in refusing to hear evidence for the material of controversy. A parallel provision in California's civil procedure code, and someone will tell me whether I quoted the provision. I think I quoted the provision from the domestic section of the law, but this is not a provision that's excluded. This is still applicable in an international arbitration where the arbitrators have refused to give evidence material to the controversy. And then when a foreign award is brought to the United States for confirmation, of course, the court may refuse on grounds, limited grounds set forth in the New York Convention, may refuse recognition and enforcement inter alia under 5.1b if the party against whom the award was invoked was unable to present his or her case, and the answer trial model law, Article 36, where in subsection essentially adopts the formulation of the New York Convention. To put some meat on the bones of how courts near to many of you in Southern California think about this, we have a quotation here from a relatively recent Ninth Circuit case talking about what would be its conception of arbitrator misconduct in the process that would justify setting aside an award under 10A3. And here the example given is where an arbitrator's ex parte receipt of evidence affected the outcome, or where the arbitrator's post-hearing consultation with an outside expert tainted the panel's decision. Equally in the Northern District of California recently, in order to justify vacating an award, the arbitrator's refusal to hear evidence must demonstrate bad faith or be so gross as to amount to misconduct. You would think that such rigid tests would prevent parties from going to court to set aside awards for on the basis of due process, but they don't. And you would think such rigid standards would create substantial flexibility and comfort for arbitrators, but in reality, often they don't. And with those comments, I'll turn it over for elaboration to Judge Sofair.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Rich. Chernik is a very forceful person, as all of you know, and will attest. When he invites you to something, it's different from the normal invitation you get. But it is greased with 25-year-old wines from his collection, and he boastfully points out that he bid for them in auctions many, many years ago, so it doesn't really cost him that much, quote-unquote. Well, anyway, it's a real pleasure to be here. I joined the advisory board, in fact, at their invitation of USC, and it's been great to witness other people working so hard to make ADR work meaningfully and not have to do much yourself. I sit and I watch these young professors and administrators doing a fabulous job at proving that now that the bar won't allow a two-year law school, they're going to make the third year meaningful somehow. It seems to me that that's what's going on here, and it's a really impressive thing. So I thought my assignment was to talk about due process, and the title sort of shifted a little bit. But I think, anyway, Mark has handled it very beautifully by breaking it down into these two questions of how much process is due, what is abuse of due process, and then the other, the discovery issue. And I'm sure we'll all mix it up here. I know all these people on the panel, and it's going to be fun. So I thought a good place to start on when is due process, what process is due, is with Lucy Reed's recent article. Because if you haven't read it, it's a must read. It's in the LCIA journal. It came out a couple months ago. And it's very elegantly written. It's a fresh field lecture, which is given every year. And Lucy is now an academic, in addition to having been everything in this field. She was assistant legal advisor when I was legal advisor, and was in charge of the Hague operation, which of course included not only the Iran Claims Tribunal, the Iran U.S. Claims Tribunal, but the ICJ, everything that went on there. So it was enormously experienced, very intelligent, charming, tough-minded lady, and written a really excellent piece, which I've even cited to make sure you read it, that makes the point that Mark just made in great detail, going through each of the standards in each of the applicable, potentially applicable statutes and treaties, what due process requires, and pointing out that, generally speaking, courts virtually never hold that due process has been denied under any of those standards. So I sort of read this and felt everything that Lucy said was right, but I felt that as a practitioner, in addition to teaching, but as a practitioner, that the problem of being an activist, brave arbitrator, controlling everything and making everything efficient in your process, even if you're a sole arbitrator in a case, is that in due process, a no-nonsense approach, in real arbitration, a no-nonsense approach has really more dimensions to it than Lucy examined. Lucy did thoroughly examine those general statutes and treaties and formulations that exist on what process is due. But the fact is that there are more dimensions to due process and arbitration than merely those statutes. In fact, I would submit that the rules of arbitration that are often incorporated into arbitration agreement, and then the ad hoc rules that parties adopt in their arbitration agreements are frequently much more constraining and consequential, potentially, than the general rules about due process. And, you know, there are very few cases that get to the courts where you actually see how this works, but one that stands out for me, and I just give it as an example, is a Florida case years ago where an arbitrator simply disregarded the party's agreement that there would be no punitive damages issued in the case. And now the party, you know, there's nothing due process in the abstract sense related to the punitive damages issue. If you grant punitive damages in the case, and you have a proper record, and you do it properly, and there's no other constraint involved, you're not going to be held to violate due process. But if the parties have told you that they don't want you and are not giving you power to grant punitive damages, that's it. And the court found a gross violation the agreement, that the arbitrator had no authority to do that, and vacated that part of the award. So what I'm saying here is, and I'll say it very briefly in these three or four slides I have, because I know it's interesting, and much more interesting to talk about these things than to lecture about them. Tribunals are bound in varying degrees to apply due process rules. They are due process rules. They're much more specific than the general due process principle that are derived from all these sources. And now there's also the realities that I list on this slide of overzealous attorneys, the process of cultivating grounds of error, inexperienced, timid arbitrators. It's sometimes wise to be timid when you are inexperienced. The uncertainties as to your sanction authority. That is very prevalent throughout the profession. The absence of a merit-based review, which focuses the attorney's concentration on the procedural issues. The lack of public accountability of tribunals. That was pointed out in the morning session, where you have you don't have exposure of what conflicts you have, what old cases you have in some systematic way. Federal judges have to reveal every investment they have and their families have, and that's not true in arbitration. And arbitration service companies have not yet gotten together and created a universal data bank. Because if we don't, the government someday is going to order that be done, and it'll be done by the government rather than by us. So that's something I look forward to seeing. Also, you have to understand arbitrators, and I'm sure you do, don't want to alienate a firm or a party. It isn't that you're going to fawn over some law firm or some big company that might have other cases in the future. But I mean, be sensible in evaluating, you know, what can arbitrators do in the real world. Well, they're not going to do something with a prominent law firm or even one lawyer who is entitled to respect that's going to alienate that person And now that I know from Carrie that there's a digital review going on, and I think the answer to that, Carrie, is that you don't look. You just don't look. But the fact is that they're gonna post what you did. And there are consequences to being nasty, I like to feel. And then finally, the vagueness and informality of procedural and evidentiary rules in arbitration. I practiced federal law. I was a prosecutor, I was a litigator, I was a district judge. And I just don't have this aversion to the federal rules that a lot of arbitrators seem to assume is appropriate in arbitration. Of course, you don't want to apply the federal rules rigidly in smaller cases, but big law firms and big cases and want that certainty of the federal rules. And even if you don't apply all the federal rules, some of them might serve your interests in a given case. And the rules of evidence in particular, they're general enough for me. They're vague enough. Without them, arbitration tends to get out of control. And people then want to introduce evidence because you let in some evidence, oh, what harm will it do? Well, it does a lot of harm. It causes a lot of costs. And that's one of the things you just feel as an arbitrator. They expect you to let in evidence. And so you've got to deal with that. That's not so easy to deal with. And I give this illustrative hypothetical of a crazy contract where a California engineering firm that's a Delaware corporation says you've got to have Delaware law govern an employment agreement, and the tribunal is going to consist of two managers of software engineering firms, and then you have to have a Delaware chancellor as the chairman. I've had cases where you couldn't find a chairman that was qualified. You just couldn't find it. And you somehow, because that's in the agreement, you've got to try, and then if you can't succeed, you've got to try to get the parties to agree on some other type of chairman or to waive the requirement, which you often can do, but sometimes you can't do. And then you have to have the guts with the service provider behind you to go ahead and apply an alternative method of selection. But you don't jump right to that. You go through the hoops, because you have to go through the hoops. You have been hired to go through the hoops, to treat the parties with respect, and it is their process after all. So you just let your imaginations run a little bit wild, and you can imagine how many different complications can arise with that kind of an agreement or any kind of other agreement you can imagine. So here are the hearings to take no more than 4 days. No depositions, maximum 3 witnesses each side, including 1 expert. Well, you know what happens in the real world. The parties start doing things. They start agreeing on depositions. And here you are, you're sitting there, and everyone tells you, you're a good arbitrator, don't allow depositions, you know, the parties agreed to no depositions. Well, now the parties have changed their mind. What are you going to do about it? You know, and maybe they... Maybe they'll fight over the number of depositions, and you'll have to somehow decide that issue. Then you've got the JAMS rules. You've got to look at the JAMS rules. You've got to take them seriously. And these are the kind of difficulties that... And here are all the potentially applicable standards beyond there's the California arbitration law for this, California employment law, which is very specialized. Federal Arbitration Act, UNCTRAL, New York Convention, JAMS commercial rules, and then the contract provision. Just to keep in mind, you can't just look at the New York Convention and say, oh, well, I'm not worried. Due process satisfied here. You've got to look at all those potential things and what the parties want. So my conclusion, prevent abuse of the due process argument, but carefully, because arbitrators are bound to apply far more detailed and varied due process rules than the general standards and statutes and treaties. Lawyers are lawyers. Arbitrators have limited powers derived from party agreement. There's no adequate and uniform disclosure system, so stop playing like God.
No, non-public, these are non-public proceedings. They're seldom reviewed, so arbitrators are, lawyers are going to behave a little bit more radically. And public policy is always a wild card in this, so you have to take that into account. You just have to, as unreasonable as it may seem in a given case. If you're dealing with an international situation where there's a country that has different environmental rules, let's say, than another country, or different morality rules, as we were talking about last night, than a different country in commerce. You just have to take those things into account. And they don't fit neatly into any of these general categories. So make sure due process is provided and more complicated, is more complicated than the general rules. And I would submit, and I, there's no way I can prove this, but I would submit that the very few cases in which it is found that arbitrators have denied due process reflects the efforts arbitrators are forced to make to avoid error, to avoid serious error, i.e. error that would lead to the vacating of the law. Thank you.
Jack, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. During the 40 years I was a litigator and attending cocktail parties, I would always be asked, what do you do for a living? And that in New York certainly goes along with, where do you live? Where do your children go to school? Outside New York, they also ask you what church you attend. And I would say, I'm a lawyer. What kind of law? I'm a litigator. And people pretty much would lose interest, except those who wanted to know which firm I worked for. And it reminds me of the beginning of the play, A View from the Bridge, where Alfieri, who's the neighborhood lawyer in the Italian working class, dock neighborhood of Redwood, Brooklyn, addresses the audience and says, you see how uneasily they nod at me? You see how uneasily they nod at me? It's because I'm a lawyer. To meet a lawyer or a priest in this neighborhood is considered unlucky. They only think of us in connection with disaster, and they'd rather not get too close. So after 40 years as a litigator, I became neutral, and people became very interested. People were interested in how problems got solved outside the public eye. People were even more interested in knowing what a mediator did, and when they realized that that's the same thing you do when two kids can't share a toy, it became even more interesting. And I realized that they were more interested in getting close. And it occurred to me that while lawyers are instinctively not trusted, including by their clients, there's tension everywhere. When an arbitrator or a mediator is engaged, it usually begins with an act of trust, because they're not imposed upon you and you have a choice, and you often have to choose with the other side. And so it's one of the first acts of consent and agreement between parties who are using the process because they disagree. And I mentioned trust because people who engage with each other in a trusting process, even one that has conflict, with someone they trust, I call that person a trusted stranger, whether it's an arbitrator or a mediator, are more likely to think that the outcome is fair. And I'll get back to what Laura's doing in a minute, but the other great American writer who deserves to be quoted is Rich Chernick, who said, or purportedly said to the dailyjournal.com, arbitrators, in my opinion, ought to be very proactive from the very beginning. They ought to roll up their sleeves and work with the parties from the very first conference to figure out a process that works for that case, which is the definition, in my view, of what any neutral should do, arbitrator, mediator, problem solver. It's what you don't get in the courts. And if you're a wise consumer or a lucky consumer of ADR services, you're going to find people who have the attitude that Rich has towards arbitration. And as I said before, I think the same is true with mediation. I often say, usually to groups that don't have many judges in them, that if people could pick their judges there'd be a lot of underemployed judges. And you know, whether that's wise or not is another issue. But people get their reputations, whether well advertised and correctly reviewed or not, they get them justly over time. And the beautiful part about ADR is that you make choices, and when you make those choices wisely, and the people you engage behave correctly, which sometimes means courageously and aggressively, I think you're more likely never to wind up in a situation where people are even thinking about whether it was fair. Now, there are all these rules and guidelines about what constitutes due process and what constitutes fairness, and I believe that the idea that Rich used the word proactive, I believe that if the neutral is not proactive, all sorts of negative things happen, because what's happening is you have active lawyers, proactive lawyers, aggressive lawyers, sometimes abusive lawyers. And while my experience has been very favorable with arbitrators, I don't see it, other mediators except at conferences and they tell me about their lives. It's kind of a solitary pursuit. Most of the arbitrators I've been privileged to serve with, including Abe, including folks at JAMS, are people who look at it this way. They go at it proactively. And so, in my view, whether you're in an arbitration or mediation, you take the energy coming from the lawyers who are in attendance, and you turn that energy into something productive. Lawyers will test the outer bounds. You have to always be managing them to keep the thing going forward. So they're going to get off into dispositive motions. They're going to want to have too many depositions. They're going to want to put in too much evidence. They're going to want to take too many days. We like to think that their clients are constraining them, but that's often not the case. The clients are sometimes there. I've been in arbitrations where there are 10 lawyers on each side and five client representatives. So you're there alone. Standing for the proposition that arbitration or mediation is supposed to be fair and efficient, and you have to constantly be vigilant to do that. So I'll just say a few of the things that I think need to be done. As Carrie said, you need to listen. And I have found that I didn't start listening really well until I stopped being a practicing lawyer. Because when you're listening with an agenda, when you're listening with a sense of liability, a fear that you will be criticized, you're not fully listening. You're always thinking of what's happening next. And so when you listen, you can also be more creative in coming up with solutions. You show respect for people. And I will say that there are very respected people in our society, even respected judges, who are respected for their ability, but not for the respect they show to the people who appear before them. And that's something that, you know, you have to work on. It might be you either have it or you don't. You either respect people or you don't. Just as I believe mediation is a very special calling. You either have a mediator's instincts and desire to solve a problem, or you just know some mediation techniques. And so respect is either there or not, and you have to learn how to deal with people who don't respect you, including co-arbitrators, counsel, witnesses, etc. One of the places I think where arbitration and mediation actually meet, and at least for me it works, because I have a mediator's heart and a mediator's head all the time. I believe that in an arbitration, I'm there to resolve the problem with them to a conclusion as an arbitrator. But overall, I'm there to help them resolve their problem. So if I can front load the discussion in the arbitration with what are the issues and what's the proof going to be, that forces the lawyers to do something that they instinctively don't do till near the end. And so when I find out that the ships were crossing in the night and I get them near each other and they see each other, I'm an arbitrator. I'm not trying to mediate the case, but I like to think that my cases tend, when I'm a sole arbitrator especially, they tend to settle because people see, well, I'm just putting it in front of them and showing it to them in a way they don't get to see it. And also asking questions. If you're a good listener, you can ask questions even-handedly without criticism or sarcasm. And you may ask questions that are rhetorical. Sometimes in an arbitration, I'll say, well, I'm going to ask these questions. You don't have to answer them to me, but answer them, because we're going to have a hearing here. So these are management techniques. And sometimes what you have to do, as I said earlier, is to be courageous and stop people from doing what they want to do. There are a lot of techniques for that, but there's no substitute for an arbitrator who sometimes says enough, who doesn't worry about getting vacated. You will rarely, I don't know if you're ever going to get vacated for letting a piece of evidence come in for the third time. And you will be more respected and everyone will live happily ever after. So I think that it's good to remember that you're trusted, people agree to hire you, take that trust and go with it and don't be afraid. And then people will also be happy to talk to you at cocktail parties. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Jack Abe, I want to put a question to you, and I hope this isn't too long-winded, but I commented to Cedric during the break that the voluntariness of arbitration often is a voluntariness at the beginning when an agreement is signed and the dispute resolution clause is enacted. But by the time the dispute actually arises, one or the other parties is eager to resolve the dispute elsewhere, presumably in a court, and a very high percentage of arbitrations start out with someone trying to bring a plenary proceeding in a court and having a motion to compel made against them that is granted. And in the United States, of course, we have a very strong doctrine about competence, which leaves questions about arbitrability, save as to whether there's an arbitration agreement at all, to the courts. And we've all read a bit about that issue in the context of Stephanie Clifford and David Dennison and the like over the last But you have that tension about voluntariness from the very beginning in a lot of proceedings. I wonder how you, Abe, you, Jack, as arbitrators deal with that to manage aggressively and at the same time gain the party's respect to legitimize the proceedings at a very early stage.
Well, you know, one thing I'd like to point out, and I'm sure everybody here has heard this, that an arbitration provision is something that somebody who you don't know and never met agreed to some years ago. So you're living with it. So it becomes voluntary in an immediate sense when they get before you and, you know, they like being there. But on the question of the authority of the arbitrator, that's either decided, it goes to court, the courts write in most cases, it sends it to the arbitrator, and I think that's something that you need to treat as a strictly legal preliminary matter. And that's one of the most law-like, straightforward things you need to do as an arbitrator, because the one thing you never want to do is exceed your power. And that's the number one thing.
Abe? I agree with that. And I think that you have to be respectful of the fact that it's the courts that ultimately decide if there's an agreement to arbitrate unless that's allocated to a tribunal. And that's, generally speaking, something that you can ask for. And I have frequently suspended proceedings while courts have made that decision. Or if I'm pretty confident that I do have the authority, the Supreme Court has allowed arbitrators to begin proceedings, even though a judicial proceeding is underway. Because you will meet, for sure, arbitrators who are in good faith and making an argument that they can choose to go to court rather than arbitrate. And you will meet arbitrators who are not in good faith in arguing that. And I mean, it's pretty blatant. I was called once, staggered by the invitation to help a company stay out of arbitration. And then I told them, I read the papers and I said, you can't stay out of arbitration, you've agreed to arbitrate. So, we don't mind. We know that we're going to be ordered to arbitrate someday, but in the meantime, we're going to spend a lot of time in court and we'll pay you well to help us do it. Well, you know, of course, there are people like that. And of course, there are lawyers who will accept assignments like that, and you just have to be, as an arbitrator, you have to realize that that is part of the world. And don't get angry, you know, just get even.
One more question for both of you, and again, I'll try to frame it briefly. I think one of your bullets was on overzealous attorneys, and to give an example of that, I'll come back to the case Rich and I had together a year or more ago. Here we had one party representing the American party against a non-U.S. party in an international dispute, saying from the very beginning, we already had a litigation over certain issues, and the litigation resolved everything that's here. And so we must, as a matter of fundamental fairness, have a motion to dismiss this entire proceeding right up front. It's the first thing we do, even before we have terms of reference in an ICC case. And so I framed that because the question is, well, how do you fairly rein in an overzealous party? How do you deal with that kind of aggression, which is in part calculated to test whether intimidation of the arbitrators can be a successful tactic in the arbitration?
Well, many of the institutions have rules governing dispositive motions, the AAA, the ICDR, for example, that say dispositive motions require a letter setting forth the grounds of the motion, and then the tribunal decides whether to allow a motion. I like to apply that rule to a lot of motions and applications, which is never to prevent somebody from making the application. But I'll often say, let him make it, or let's do it in the page, but you don't have to reply until I say so. So I'll give the opportunity for the person who wants relief to say what they want, and if I think this is not the time or the place, and I'm sure of it, I'll say, you don't have to reply. You're not going to make that motion now without prejudice. If it's more serious, you might let the other side say why they shouldn't be allowed to make it. But you never want to say, I don't want to hear from you. That's the worst thing you can do. And I was in a case that got vacated where one of the arbitrators got so sick of the lawyers, she actually refused to take, they physically wanted to hand her the cases, and she refused to take them. Bad decision. So yes, listen, and then if you don't permit the other side, don't allow the other side to reply while you're figuring it out, you can save a lot of back and forth and expense.
Abe, final word?
Yeah, I would just say, remember, you're just a person. Behave yourself. That's all I'm saying. I like Lucy's approach. I think you should be preventing these terror tactics in arbitration. But as we've just heard Jack say, do it intelligently. As long as you're allowing people to get their points across, whether you do it today or next week, you're going to be okay. But if you start acting like you really have some Article 3 power of some kind, my colleagues used to tell me, don't worry about it. Just take the Constitution and put it under your pillow every night. Don't worry about anything. Well, you can behave that way if you want to as a federal judge. You shouldn't. But as an arbitrator, you can't.
Well, there's an extra reason not to, because while federal judges are the most powerful people in this country, their rulings can be appealed. And as a practical matter, arbitrators have even greater power in a given case because they can get it wrong, badly wrong, and there's no remedy. And that is the one thing as an arbitrator you want to think of very carefully when you're deciding a case. You really want to get it right.
With the caveat of everything you're going to hear in the panel after lunch on appellate arbitration. Good. Let's turn now to topic number two, witnesses and information in the international, I put that in quotes deliberately, case. And we'll have a little bit of a hypothetical with weakly masked hypothetical parties, SK Electronics US Limited of San Jose and the respondent LJ Semiconductors of La Jolla, California. LJ in this equation, at least as of today, is a U.S. entity, and may remain so, we don't know. But we've made this vague enough that it's a sort of a garden variety supply contract, but the supply is a global supply agreement, but it is nominally between U.S. entities, and it's to be resolved under JAMS rules with a seat in Los Angeles, and California governing law, including the relevant provisions of the CCP. And we'll start with Martin and talk about how one approaches that case as U.S. counsel, and you may, I don't know whether you're going to say how you approach it from the standpoint of representing a U.S. party or a non-U.S. party or a little bit of each, but Martin, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, and thank you, Rich, for inviting me. It's an honor to be on this panel with these esteemed panelists, particularly Professor Sofair, Judge Sofair next to me, who's my professor in law school, and in whose class I met my wife, so I owe him a lot, in addition to a great class, commitment there. So I'm going to talk more from the practitioner's perspective. I've represented clients from Europe, Mexico, Korea, China. And in terms of the hypothetical and that framework, the first point I would make is that international companies, international clients, they want to arbitrate. They like arbitration for two main reasons, I would say. First, the efficiency of arbitration in terms of the speed to which you can get to a resolution, and also the degree to which you can agree on rules that will make things more efficient. Professor Sofair mentioned limiting depositions. You can limit the time for depositions, limit things such as PMK depositions. All that sort of thing is huge, especially when compared to the federal rules, or even worse in some cases, the state rules, in which the discovery process can drag out for years and years and years. And international clients want to avoid that. The other thing I'll say about why they want to avoid the court system is because, in many cases, they're terrified of the court system. Okay? And I'll give you an example. I handled an antitrust case in the Northern District for LG Electronics. This is public information, so we can talk about this. But the case largely turned on damages. And as most of you know, in antitrust cases, the damages come down to this very complicated economic analysis involving regression models, multiple regression models, heteroscedasticity, all these things which then a jury is asked to decide. And our client couldn't get their heads around the fact that there would be a jury deciding how much damages were at play here, just listening to two competing experts and deciding that question. We had about five mock trials until they finally said, we want out of this. So we don't want to trust this jury system anymore to figure out the damages. The other anecdote I'll give, and that's in that same case, was, and this is something Mark wanted to talk about, the cultural dynamic. And you certainly see it play out in terms of how things can reflect for an American audience versus an international audience. So the example I'll give is one of the main witnesses in that case comes from Taiwan, and his deposition was taken in Taiwan, and it was a 2 or 3 day deposition based on the use of the translator. It went on forever and ever, and it was a really important deposition. But during the deposition, he was wearing a surgical mask. And when we would play this out in the mock trials, all of the mock jurors hated the guy. Thought he was like Hannibal Lecter. Thought he was a scary person that they could believe. And they always ruled in some way against him. But from his perspective, and the reason he was wearing it, is because he was under the weather and trying to protect the other people in the room from his germs, so it was actually an act of courtesy, but people couldn't understand that. And that sort of lack of connect in terms of the cultural aspects really terrifies international companies and leads them to want to arbitrate. The other thing I'll mention on international arbitration is while many of the companies want to arbitrate and want to get into a US arbitration system, the discovery aspect, which is one of the main topics of this panel discussion, is problematic. As most of you know, international discovery is very difficult, whether you're in court or whether you're in arbitration. It takes months to get things internationally. I had another arbitration that involved a Chinese client, a large company in China, and when we were trying to obtain discovery for production in the arbitration, we ran against a few things, namely Chinese law, which has very stringent privacy law regulations where you can't just produce material or information in your possession has to be reviewed first by Chinese lawyers to ensure that it's something that can be turned over, can be produced. And that's a very cumbersome process. It's a very expensive process. And it takes time. The other thing is depositions. It's not easy to do international depositions. We found issues with that in Europe and certainly in China, where it's very difficult to hold a deposition based on these privacy laws, and you end up having to go to some third country or third jurisdiction, in this case it's Hong Kong, just to get the depositions done. So why does that happen? How does the deposition actually get done when there are these rules that prevent the efficient movement of discovery? Well, one of the tricks, which works for practitioners, which I will tell you, is where the information is within the control, maybe not custody, but within the control of the party, the arbitrator has tools, including one, finding an adverse inference, where it's under the control of the party, and the party is using some sort of international rules to delay the production. And the other thing is turning the rationale for arbitration on its head and making the process less efficient. So if the discovery is produced, the hearing, the plenary hearing, will be delayed. And that's the last thing that many of these international clients want to know. They go to arbitration less efficient, they don't want to be delayed. So in this hypothetical that is positive, it's not so thinly veiled. LG Semiconductors sounds a lot like something that I'm familiar with. In international arbitration, yes, in the sense of discovery. The company may be a U.S. affiliate of an international corporation, but because, generally speaking, the discovery is going to be overseas, it transforms itself into an international arbitration where rules of international discovery apply, and as I said, those can be quite cumbersome. There's something else here, practical and tactical aspects of disclosure discovery. Practically, the reality is that it's difficult to force the discovery hand in these instances. In the US, in terms of dealing with third parties, for instance, there is a procedure in the Federal Arbitration Act where you can have a hearing and bring the third party in to obtain documents or obtain testimony. That's not going to work internationally. Internationally, you have to go through the Hague Convention or something even more onerous, depending on what country is a signatory of the Hague Convention, and you're just not going to get that information. So really, when you're dealing with these arbitrations that are semi-international based on the location of the parent and the location of the discovery, you have to exercise some power over the party. And that's namely the two things that I mentioned. One is the fact that if the discovery isn't produced and isn't provided, there'll be delay in the hearing, which is the last thing the client wants to hear, or possibly, depending on the circumstances, an adverse inference, which is a very powerful tool against the party to get that company to comply as soon as possible.
Very good. EY, before let's hear from you on these issues, and then I'll have some questions for both.
Thank you. As you surmise, the parties who chose arbitration has many reasons. One of the reasons for parties choose international arbitration is to avoid a court proceeding, and especially when the number of issues that they want to avoid court proceeding is, I guess, the biggest topic is to avoid discovery. So the parties choose international arbitration to avoid a U.S.-style discovery. That's why the IBA rules of taking evidence generally suggest a more moderated document disclosure than it's different from the U.S.-style discovery. Even ICDR rules says that they avoid discovery. But in the HIPO case, the South Korean company who have incorporated in the United States chose GEMS rules seated in LA, so they are in this territory, so that applying lex arbitrary, so that it appears to be natural that the discovery will take place. So then it throws upon two questions. Can arbitrator impose discovery over a disagreed party? Or should arbitrator do so? That's a big issue here. Giving you a bit of a background of civil law countries like South Korea. South Korea is based on civil law countries, civil law jurisdiction, and it doesn't have any discovery. There is a very narrow document production phase. It is especially not much possible that you get the some helpful documents from the other side. So it's very rare that you get the document. So there is no full records and facts on the table throughout the proceeding. So the system is different, and it actually shapes the party's behavior differently, because the South Korean companies or all other East Asian companies, like Chinese companies, Japanese companies, do not expect that the documents would be produced throughout the litigations. So the way they maintain the documents are entirely different from the American companies. So it goes into a difficult question, such as the privileges. The privilege is well developed in the common law countries, especially the United States. Why? Because there's wide discovery. So then there is an issue of waiver of privileges. The people are very, very carefully dealing with the privilege discussion so that they'll be protected in the discovery. Since there's no discovery, then in the East Asian company, they don't deal with this privileged so-called communication in such a manner. So there's some kind of discussion with the lawyer, with someone else, third party. So there's third party advisors are on the list and so forth. So then it raises an issue of the waiver. We had a recent case in Singapore against a Japanese company. And in following the IBA guidelines, we make some type of document production. But then we drove upon the privilege laws and realized that the Japanese company put a correspondence which showed that there were third party who were participating in so-called privilege discussion. We challenged that, and then the tribunal ordered that it's a waived, so that Japanese company had to produce these so-called privilege documents. And it was very harmful for them because it contained every kind of harmful discussion within themselves. So it really raises enormous amount of issues. On the other hand, we had recently arbitration against Chinese companies in the common law jurisdiction. The Korean party made a long list of document production requests. Nevertheless, tribunal actually rejected almost everything. 90% of document production was rejected. It was very, very narrow. So it's much narrower than general international arbitration. Why? These arbitrators are from the United States, Australia, and England. They know the discovery rules. Nevertheless, they consider the expectation of the parties and nationalities of the parties, and they believe that the wide range of document production are not fair to the Chinese parties. So that's kind of a dynamics in international arbitration. So despite that, since this company, the South Korean subsidiary, incorporated in Korea, so even though they would argue that the discovery should not apply to them, can arbitrator do so? Are they concerned about a world being set aside? I don't think so, because they are on Los Angeles, with the lex arbitrary, the arbitrator has a power to order any type of document disclosure under the GEMS rules, so they can do so, certainly. The court in the United States will not set aside. Even if it was brought into Korean court would not set aside, because they will delegate to the arbitrator the power. Now, should the arbitrator do so? That's a whole lot of different questions. As we discussed about self-regulation of the arbitrator, arbitrator, once they are appointed, they have a huge power. They have a power of district judge, high court judge, and Supreme Court judge. And then the later court review is only on the procedural issue, not on the merits. They have a huge power. So they have to regulate themselves. So they ultimately, you know, they might concern about their work being set aside. But in addition to the, even though it's not set aside, if it's not well accepted by the parties, ultimately the users, so then they will not come back to the arbitration. And also, what arbitration has to do is the right thing. So now, what does GEMS efficiency guide says? Even though GEMS had a bit of a broader in giving a discovery power, what it says is that the arbitrator has to think about this in setting up the e-disclosure, such as expectation under the legal regime, if the legal regime is different. Any nationalities of the party, the legal tradition of the parties, or home states, and parties' expectation to the arbitration. So these are all have to be kind of considered. So in terms of South Korean subsidiary, I think that they have to produce the documents under this company. But what if you know, U.S. subsidiary says that we have a very short document retention policy so that virtually all documents are deleted and destroyed. And probably the other side may say that, well, you have a server so you can restore it and then produce it. But the server is in South Korea. So it's a property of their parent. So should you order a discovery from the parent? But the parent, South Korean company, says, I'm not the party to the arbitrator, so I'm not going to produce. What can you do? The other side may say that, oh, the arbitrator, they're hiding it, you should draw a negative inference. You could certainly do so, because under the GEMS rule, Article 33.1, arbitrator's power to draw a negative inference. Is it fair? Because, you know, the South Korean company didn't expect that their whole lot of document their positions would occur, or servers has to be searched, and so forth. So then, this is really, really complicated issues. There's no one-size-fits-all answer to this. I think what I recommend is that you need to have a very early discussion. It's a case management conference. There are a number of issues that you have to discuss. But I guess that you have to really focus on the ground rule as to the discovery. Even though it's a city in Lex, LA and Lex Arbitrary, you don't assume that parties naturally would abide by the US court-like discovery. Rather, it has to be spelled out in early phase and hear from the parties as to what their expectation is, what their objection is, what the kind of burden that they have, and then make some kind of ground rules, and then also possibly mention about a sanctions to that if it is not complied with. And then it makes all fair to everybody. So then you have much higher kind of value of, so to speak, acceptability or a persuasiveness from the arbitrator. Thank you.
I have a question for both of you about, based on your experiences, how do the decisions get made by big corporations in Asia as to whether in an international arbitration they will embrace American procedure or not? And that there are a series of decisions, I guess. One is the arbitration clause before a dispute, but even when a dispute then arises, well, should it be handled by Asian counsel with assistance from U.S. counsel, or should it be U.S. counsel only? Shall we appoint a party-appointed arbitrator of Asian background, or should we appoint someone who's already a California lawyer or a New York lawyer familiar with the applicable law? How do those decisions get made? Because I think those decisions have a very powerful effect on how the Asian companies then approach discovery. In my own experience, sometimes when the decisions are made in favor of an American approach, select American counsel, American arbitrators, well, then you bought into the American process, right? But, so it's really to go back to the roots to understand how the decisions get made.
Yeah. California is the sixth biggest economy in terms of world GDP ranking. Korea is 11th. So maybe it's, their knowledge of discovery will be half of the big companies, Samsung, Hyundai, these companies, back in 20 years ago, when they come over to overseas United States, they didn't expect this at all. They made a lot of mistakes, sanctioned by not producing it, contempt of court, and so to speak. Now they understand that they have to abide by the U.S. rules. And once they incorporate business here, they need to conduct the business under the U.S. rules, including this resolution. So that I should say that if I were asked by the Samsung, Hyundai, SK, LG, then my advice would be that you need to have a U.S. lawyer. Probably you should also consider appointing a U.S. arbitrator who will knowledgeable on this discovery issue, so that you could be have a better kind of organized arbitration. So I think that this decision-making process, but still I guess that there are some type of resistance internally, even though general counsel understand, but the business executive do not understand why we should bring harmful documents for us to the other side and things like that. Maybe a serious discussion. Nevertheless, I think gradually they are going in that direction. Having said that, though, despite the well-established industry in Korea, the companies below these big conglomerates, Jabul, these mid-sized companies never went outside. They were all very local, domestic, and they simply follow the big companies, and they encounter so many problems. If I suggest that you need to abide by the U.S. rules and so forth, and then they may be really resisting it. And they may simply appoint a Korean or the civil law arbitrator or the civil law, even lawyer to represent this case. Somehow they may run the risk, they may strongly object the discovery, imposing discovery from the arbitrator, then they may have all or nothing. But that's a kind of a situation.
And I would just add to Eli's point, in terms of the larger corporations in China and Korea and other Asian countries, they've become highly sophisticated now, having built so much in the U.S., having experience in the U.S. So many of them have legal departments that have attorneys who have degrees from U.S. law schools or British law schools. So they know the lay of the land. They're not foolish enough to go and try to represent themselves in these cases, but they know they're very sophisticated in terms of choosing counsel, knowledgeable counsel, who know not only U.S. procedure, but also are sensitive to the difficulties of getting discovery from a place like China or Korea. The other thing I'll say is in terms of what rules are chosen, I'll go back to the point of how these corporations favor arbitration, like arbitration, because of that flexibility in the rules. Having the ability to limit certain discovery, form rogs, depositions, things of that sort, limit the hours, limit the number. That's a very important thing for a company that wants to resolve an issue quickly.
Question. Gary Benson. I had a question, personally to Mr. Estrada and Dr. Clark, but I'd be glad to hear responses from the entire panel. This debate about discovery and disclosure has certainly been around for a while. It occurs to me that in the U.S. we have a very different concept of international arbitration than in many other jurisdictions. Perhaps that's true of every jurisdiction. It's always somewhat different. But here in the U.S., I'm wondering, first of all, Mr. Estrada, do your civil law clients actually want discovery, or is it simply a function of the arbitrator not enforcing classic principles of international arbitration? Is it a function of having a clause like as in this hypothetical, or is it simply the lawyers who are pressing for arbitration and pressing for discovery? And the Congress question for Dr. Park, do your clients want discovery, or are they simply agreeing to rules not realizing what's being provided for?
So I'll do a first on that, and I'll say it depends on the case. So if they're getting sued by a much smaller player who may not have a lot of relevant discovery, they don't want to produce a lot of discovery, they just want to resolve the case quickly and as efficiently as possible. In many instances, when you're dealing with an arbitration agreement, it's two sophisticated companies entering into the agreement, and both of them, in my case, I've had many cases where we're the ones pursuing the case against the other side, and they certainly want discovery in that instance. Notwithstanding that, they recognize that the principle of what's good for the goose is good for them as well, so they want to limit the discovery to a certain extent. But they certainly want the discovery and favor the rules, the U.S. rules in terms of getting that discovery. Generally speaking, I found that the federal rules, if they can be used in the arbitration, are favored, particularly in regard to experts, because, for instance, California versus federal law, you're guaranteed you have a right to a report in under federal rules, whereas in state court, it's more fluid and you may not get the report. That type of specificity and concreteness and the ability to review something like that is certainly favored by the clients I represent.
Yeah, briefly, generally East Asian companies based in civil law tradition prefer to avoid the discovery. Nevertheless, there are some exceptions. Firstly, if they have to come into the U.S. market despite the fact that they have to be submissive to the discovery, then I think that if their business needs is great, then they will simply take the risk. Secondly, there are some companies, recently we encountered in China, they don't mind coming to do a discovery in wide range because they have very short retention policy. So they don't have anything to lose, so they don't have any risk.
We have one more question, two more questions, and then our fearless leader is going to cut us off.
Two more questions. Nathan O'Malley, Mr. Keeler. I just, picking up on Gary's point, because he's absolutely correct, there are competing views out there concerning what international arbitration is, in terms of whether or not we incorporate U.S. discovery procedures or not in those kinds of proceedings. I refer in this regard back to Rusty Clark, well-known arbitrator, wrote a piece a few years ago, and he pointed out that neutrality is the key, one of the key issues of why we have international arbitration. And his position was that neutrality not only speaks to the nature of the background, the jurisdictional background of the arbitrators, but also to the procedure that's applied. And it's defeating of that principle when we come to international arbitration, whether it be in LA or whether it be in any other place. And we see the local customs being applied in the context of, it's in inverted commas, international arbitration. So I just was curious if you subscribe to that point of view, that what international arbitration really ideally subscribes to is the idea that there is not only just the neutrality of the arbitrator, but a neutral, even expectation procedure, incorporating things like the IBA rules and looking to the conventions that are applied normally in international.
Yeah, that's a good point. It really depends upon what party chooses. Even though we have arbitration, two arbitrations. One is as in the hypo, they choose LA as a seat, but at the same time they choose GEMS. And GEMS arbitration rules is much more accommodating the discovery context. Whereas if they choose ICDR, the ICDR is much more avoiding discovery, and also the parties drawing upon a terms of reference or a memorandum of issues refer to the IBA guidelines. So then, even though it's a seated in LA, I guess that their discovery or data production is much narrower. But if they don't, then I think as long as they chose GEMS, I think that they should abide by the rules. That's my point. And then we could call both of them mutual. Yeah.
So you would look at the rules more than the seat for what? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. If I could just add one example of that, I think there really is a standard understanding of international arbitration. And in general, people expect, if they're in international arbitration, that there won't be any depositions, and that you'll have document discovery in a certain process, in accordance with a certain procedure, and IBA rules will apply, certain rules of evidence that, you know, are well known. But there are the weirdest exceptions. I mean, you just get these parties will do. I had a case where with a foreign country and a company in America and a company in a foreign country, and they had ICC arbitration managed by the ICC, and they adopted the federal rules explicitly in the agreement, not just later, but in the agreement. And they had the arbitration in San Francisco, and it was like a federal case, complete. Wild, and it was an ICC case. So that can, it just, parties decide. In fact, you know, parties can decide, whole industries can decide that there's not going to be any review by anybody of anything that happens in their industry. And so you have to keep in mind that it isn't even possible to say the words due process with regard to an industry where everyone participates, like the jewelry industry, for example, agrees that there will not be due process as we understand it. The MTA in New York is a notorious example of how you have to get an MTA contract, you have to agree that all disputes as to the contract interpretation will be resolved by the MTA manager. So, you know, you're not going to be able to appeal to court to the MTA, but the cost of the contract is going to go up, right? I mean,
One more question, please.
Hi, I'm wondering what your views are on compelling witness testimony in international arbitration, especially when the seat is here but your witness is out of country. Obviously, you can't use the FAA anymore, and if sometimes you can use the Arbitration Act of 96 in English courts, but when none of that is an option, and your only option is letter of requests to foreign courts, and to make this even more complicated, we're talking here about countries like mine, former Yugoslavia countries, Hungary, Eastern European countries, where corruption is an issue. Their courts are reluctant to have that big investor question, and he's your key investor. What are your views? How do you resolve this issue?
Who wants that one?
I'll just jump in quickly and simply. Generally speaking, American law does not provide the ability to use a letter rogatory or letter request procedure to obtain testimony from abroad for purposes of arbitration. In the handout concerning the model arbitral witness summons, you'll find a section for those of you who are real junkies. In an arbitration where I was counsel for an American party against the Japanese party, and the Japanese party had used an expert that was the Tokyo office of a U.S.-seated global consulting firm. And they had decided not to have the consulting firm testify, but my client wanted the evidence rather than the inference that would arise from their failure to testify. And we sought to have the subpoena enforced to get the testimony from the Tokyo office through the service of the subpoena on the U.S. headquarters. And the various reasons which you'll read about in that model, and some of the handouts, enforcement of that subpoena was denied.
I'll just add, in my experience, nearly impossible. I had a case once where you wanted to get a third party testimony from someone in Ukraine, and it's almost impossible to get, much less than a timely case. And even where the third party voluntarily would appear for a deposition, there are laws in many countries against taking sworn statements without the consent of the government or the presence of a government official, so you can get arrested for doing something like that. So even if it's voluntary, in a case I had once, you move to a neutral country, but the dynamics are very complicated, it's very difficult.
So we're about to adjourn for lunch, but before we leave the subject, I wanted to recommend the document that Mark referred to, the Model Federal Arbitration Summons to Testify, is a handout that's out in the lobby. Mark was the chair of the committee on the New York City Bar that created this. It is not just a guide to summons under federal FAA and federal procedure, but it's also a treatise on various aspects of how courts treat issues of summoning witnesses to testify both at hearings and pre-hearing. So it's a very good guide for you if you haven't read it. Lunch is in the lobby. It's box lunch.